AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 61 for Thursday, June 24th, 2010, Beijing Burrito. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine After Hours in the iTunes Store. Here we are. It's AutoLine After Hours again. Joining me, as always, the auto extremist, Peter DeLorenzo.
Back in my chair.
And David Welch, too. Great having you here. Huh? And for those who can't see, who are listening to the podcast right now, David Welch is here in his U.S. World Cup soccer team shirt.
That's right. This is the official, authentic team issue.
That's good. Jersey.
I got the spirit.
You do have the spirit. Well, hey, we've got a lot of news to get into here. And then later on in the show, we're going to be bringing Kathleen Ligocki on board here. But I wanted to start out, what do you guys make of these reports that are starting to surface right now that June sales don't look so good? There was a report from Mark Field saying that they're flatlining this month. Edmunds.com came out and said we're going to see a drop in sales, not versus a year ago. But as I've been saying a year ago, geez, you know, Chrysler just was out of bankruptcy. GM was still in, so let's not compare to a year ago. But Edmunds is saying even compared to May, sales are going to go down. What do you guys read into this?
I think that a lot of sales are pulled ahead with these deals.
The Toyota deals, especially when it ran into problems this year.
I don't think the economy's all that hot.
No, the economy is still very sluggish.
Yeah.
You look at last month, which in pure numbers wasn't a terrible month, but with GM and Ford and Chrysler doing as much fleet as they did. And I know you say all fleet isn't bad, but that's not the point with that argument. The point is if retail was really coming back and everyone did a lot of fleet, then we should have been up over 12 million because their explanation was the rental car companies just had big orders because they hadn't bought in a while. Okay, fine. But you take that out and it still shows that retail wasn't all that great. And just anecdotally,
I was ready to argue with you, but I do buy your argument there.
It depends what you're talking about. If you're talking about is fleet bad for profitability, you can have that debate. But if the numbers aren't that great and there's a big portion of fleet, then that tells you sales aren't that great and that tells you the economy is not that great. And you have, I've talked to a lot of dealers who tell me that this month isn't that great either. There's not a lot of consumer confidence out there still. I think consumer confidence has taken a step back.
Well, people are worried. I think the big thing, though, is I think people do want to buy. It's hard to get loans. In fact, GM's going all out right now to see if it can get other banks so that it can provide to subprime buyers. And I saw some statistic, we ran it on AutoLine Daily, that if only 1% more subprime loans could be approved, it's like an instant 350,000 sales on top of things. And if you stagger that over a few years, it's like 3.5 million more. So I think the desire's there to buy, but the banks are saying we're not going to lend to you.
And I don't understand that either, because you look at all the banking problems we had over the past couple of years, the big financial meltdown. It was primarily mortgage. It was derivatives. It was stuff like that was done high risk. Auto lending was pretty good. It took its lumps, too, because of the economy, but it's not like people got in trouble doing the, not heavy subprime, but, you know, sort of your upper-tier subprime. Companies didn't get into big trouble doing that. Turn on the spigot. Let's get some loans going.
Let's get the economy rocking again. Peter, what do you make of this report that's out there now that Ferrari on the 458 Italia is not going to offer a manual transmission? And in fact, it looks like going forward with every new model, Ferrari's not going to have an automatic. I mean, this is like heresy to enthusiasts.
Well, let's have a moment of silence for the manual gearbox and supercars because, frankly, you know, these new double-clutch boxes are just phenomenal, and you watch a Formula One race and you see those guys shift like that, and the Ferraris, the production Ferrari supercars are damn close to just like that.
But if you can't get a manual in a Ferrari.
Well, yeah, hell has frozen over officially, David.
I'm thinking here, if I bought a, I don't care what the double clutches do. I don't care about how cool I feel, you know, I'm boy racer pushing buttons like the race car drivers do. Vroom, vroom, I'm a race car driver. No, if I have a super sports car, if I have a Mini, I want a six-speed. I want to shift the gears and hit the clutch.
Yeah, Ferrari North America drops off a midnight blue 458 Italia on my doorstep, and it's got a double-clutch transmission. You know, I think I'll have to drive it. But, you know, it's a sea change. I don't know what to say. I do hope the C7 Corvette has a double-clutch automatic if they drop that ball.
I agree, because you got to keep current with technology. Yeah.
But, that's fine. I still want the option.
I'm somebody who taught myself how to heel and toe when I was 16 years old. And, you know, in fact, to even do it properly, I took a couple of cassette cases and taped them around the gas pedal just to get the gas pedal up even with the brake pedal so I could heel and toe more easily. And so I sort of pride myself in being able to do it very well, and that's going away. And to me, that's part of the pleasure of driving.
Sure, it's a lost art. You got a whole generation of kids who, you know, stick shift. They're like, huh?
Right.
You know, the driver's ed programs don't teach them.
But isn't that more here than over in Europe? Ferrari sells a lot of cars over there. Aren't the European drivers going to be unhappy with that?
No. European drivers love the DCTs, the dual clutch transmissions. In fact, you know, in Europe, it's always been the opposite of the United States. Here, 90-95% of all cars are automatics. There, until recently, it's been the opposite. They've all been manuals. But dual clutch transmission is really catching on, and people who do a lot of stop and go driving all of a sudden realize, you know, it's nice not to have a clutch pedal.
Yeah, it's significant.
Another thing that we saw come out this week, Germany is going to double the blend rate of ethanol in gasoline. They essentially have E5, 5% ethanol. They're going to go to 10%. And we saw the EPA delay yet again its decision as to whether or not in this country we should go from E10 up to E15. Any thoughts on that?
Does Germany get their ethanol from us?
You know, that's a good question. I don't think we export a whole lot of ethanol. Most of what we produce here, I know we do export some.
Yeah.
But I couldn't tell you. I mean, and I was looking for the numbers this week to answer that, because I had even seen a stat that said we were exporting ethanol to Brazil. But when I really dug into it, I couldn't find the data that proves it.
Brazil exports quite a bit, I thought. But who knows?
But they
can't answer the question. We'll have to look it up for next week.
I don't think I'd want to be one of those tanker captains driving one of those boats across the Atlantic loaded with ethanol. You know, it's just like I'd be nervous the whole way. Put that cigarette out, damn it.
Well, to me, it's interesting. In fact, I did my blog on Autoblog this week about it, is how ethanol production in this country is absolutely booming. People have no idea of how it is skyrocketing, because I looked this up in 2007, which is when all the stories started to come out that, oh, we're starving the world, the bad Americans are taking all this food out just to make fuel for their SUVs and everything. We made 5.5 billion gallons of ethanol a year. Now we're up, we're more than double that. We're at 13 billion. So from 2007 to 2010, we've gone from 5.5 to 13 plus, and more being built, and cellulosic ethanol is just coming on stream right now, where you get out of the whole food equation. You start making it out of municipal waste and wood chips and strawgrass. No, what? Switchgrass. So
that's the Cascada thing.
The Cascada thing.
Cascada, there's another GM invested in that does it too. It's like Moscato or something like that.
Right.
I think it's another cellulosic company.
But I just find it interesting. You know, ethanol production booming in this country. Of course, Brazil is leading the way. Now Germany is doubling how much ethanol is going into its fuel. I'm telling you, this is not a flash in the pan. I think we're going to see a lot more of it.
Well, the other options haven't really worked. American consumers and the government don't really like diesel, so that's not taking off for a variety of reasons we've talked about.
Much hybrids. Much to our chagrin, we all love it. In fact, I'm test driving a Mercedes with a Blue Tech in it right now. It's phenomenal. That's really good.
Hybrids, still a tiny part of the market. And
what are you driving, a GLK?
Yeah, yep.
And I'm not sold there, so what else are you going to go with? I'm not sold on ethanol either, frankly, but it's an easy solution.
That's why I titled my article, Ethanol is Booming Despite All the Drawbacks. I mean, if you're looking for an alternative, it just seems to be one of the ones going on there. And that's a good segue for our next one, because Monday this week we had Joe Biden in town cutting the ribbon on a battery plant going into Michigan.
Dow Kokam,
right. And so we've gone from having zero advanced battery plants in this state and really just about in the country to now, I think, Michigan alone has 5 battery plants from suppliers, plus GM has got its own battery plant, plus Ford's building its own battery plant. And except for the GM one, everyone else is talking about making the cells here, not just assembling stuff that comes in from China or Korea.
So, well, that's what we have to do.
Right.
If we're going to get our heads above water, we have to do that. Without that, we're just dependent on another whole set of problems.
Yeah, still relying on others.
How about China out of the cheap labor business, like, overnight?
Strikes at Toyota plants after the strikes at Honda plants.
But the thing is, they're rolling strike. I mean, they're just going to keep going.
I think you're right, Peter. I think you're right. Because I thought at first, there's this Honda thing, and it went on a little bit more, and now Toyota's got a problem. And Toyota's got another problem. And now Honda's got a problem again. And then, I don't know if you guys caught it. I think you guys reported on it. Bloomberg did.
BMW
had a strike at one of its big dealerships.
Yeah, so, right.
And that's when I started to sit up and go, okay, now we better
All of a sudden, you realize why Mexico is so important.
Right.
Economic growth. In the information age, the workers who haven't been getting paid much suddenly realize there's a whole world out there that they want to participate in. They want a piece of the pie. The reason everyone's gone to China is the market, but also for parts, the wages are cheap, and they're realizing that it's on their backs. The UAW actually did something smart and voiced their support for it. If they were really smart, they'd send somebody over there.
To China, you mean?
And start talking to these labor movements.
Yeah, say, you know how much we make? You guys got to ask for more raises.
How can we translate the Beverly Hillbillies for China? Mang, move away from there.
That's great. Well, actually, this might be a good segue to bring in our guest today. Kathleen, come on in. We've got Kathy Ligocki with us today, who is... spent considerable time in Mexico, so we can ask her about stuff. So for people who don't know who you are, I got to do some amount of introduction, and I know I'm going to leave out a lot and get the rest of it wrong. But let's see, you worked in the supplier industry. I think when I first heard about you, because I heard about you before I ever met you, and I think you were with United Technologies. Is that right?
In the mid-90s.
Okay. And then you ended up at Ford Motor Company. Mm-hmm. And when I first met you, you were running Ford of Mexico.
Right.
Then you went on to some other supplier companies, mm-hmm. too. Tower Automotive being one of them. I think you took, was it Tower you took through bankruptcy?
I did, yes.
And I remember Steve Miller saying, you know, The club of CEOs is not that big. The club of CEOs who have taken a company through bankruptcy is even smaller still.
And survived.
And survived, right. That's the key one. And then you ended up doing some interesting stuff in Mexico fairly recently, right?
I did. I actually started at GM. I was at GM for 15
kidding.
Years. I know. Well, what is now Delphi, but the old Delco Electronics in Kokomo, Indiana. So I started as a factory
foreman. Because you're an Indiana gal.
Yes, I am. Kokomo, Indiana.
Did you go to Indiana?
I am an IU undergrad, yes. Yes, so I guess I should have worn my red and white.
Breaking Away.
Breaking Away. It's 78. That was the year I graduated, too.
Really? It was a great movie.
It was a great movie.
Which movie?
Breaking Away.
You'd like it.
Yeah. He's too young. It was about cyclists.
That's right.
Bike race in Bloomington, Indiana.
Check it out. Yeah. You'll like the movie.
It's a great coming-of-age movie.
Yeah,
it's one of the greatest. It is. Well, yes, I have. I mean, I've been in the business now, you think of it, over 30 years. So when I first met you at United Technologies, I actually worked for a brief, out of all those 30 years, 2 years, I left the car business thinking I would move to Paris and work for the far more glamorous air conditioning business that United Technologies owned and Carrier.
Wait, that's got to be one of these decisions where you're thinking, I don't really care who I work for. I just want to live in Paris.
Yeah, really. And was the director of manufacturing and purchasing there. But of course, UTC owned an auto business, UT Automotive, that Lear bought later. And so came to Detroit for the first time, and then Ford for 5 years, Tower for 4 years. And then the last couple years, I've been working in consulting, and I started my own consulting company. And soon after, I get a call from a guy named Ricardo Salinas, who's one of Mexico's billionaires after Carlos Slim, saying, you know, I got myself in the car business, and this business is a lot harder than it looks from the outside.
You're a billionaire.
I think Cerberus said the same thing.
They said the same thing. How do I straighten this out?
I think all the private equity firms that jumped in ended up saying that.
A lot of them did. It's you know, it's one of these businesses where they're used to, I think all of them are used to having
a few
levers.
For Cerberus, right?
No, I worked for Tower before Cerberus. I sold the company to Cerberus as we were coming out of bankruptcy. And so we did work with them. It was actually a good way to exit. And they've been good owners for Tower. But I think private equity and billionaires, what they think is, you know, if you're an auto supplier, it's easier for them because there's like 17 levers and you pull a lever and you get a reaction. At an automaker, there's like 200 levers and you pull a lever and 3 years later you get a reaction. And that just is not in their investment horizon. That's a lot harder for them to do. But it was very exciting being in Mexico, working for a Mexican billionaire, importing Chinese vehicles and selling them through a retail store. It was a very interesting kind of set of experiments.
How's that working? Are Chinese cars making inroads in Mexico?
No. What happened is, they had chosen FAW as their joint venture partner.
FAW.
Yes, FAW. And I've worked with FAW in a lot, you know, at Tower. We had a great joint venture with them. But this part of FAW, some of these companies are big companies in China. And this part of FAW was located in Tianjin. And they were kind of a backwater. FAW had bought them in 2001, kind of encouraged by the Chinese government to do that. And they thought it would be really easy to ship the product that they were shipping into the Chinese market into the Mexican market, kind of same quality level, not a lot of support, shipped off the end of the line. It was the same quality level as went into the Chinese market. The problem is Mexico's a first world market. Mexico is used to having first world level brands and products from all over the world. And so that was a challenge, the product quality. They never paid the first peso of warranty. And so despite contracts and negotiations and long discussions in China, they never did. And then the last thing was the market equation was when the peso devalued a year and a half ago and went from 10, because we were buying in dollars, you know, the peso was attached, went from 10 to 15, you just couldn't make the market equation work. So what we did is you have to scramble. What we did is we recreated value by introducing certified used cars and multi-brand service business. That was successful. We sold the agencies and then integrated the rest of the business into their transport business. And, of course, they have a very successful retail bank where they do auto financing. So we left them with the profitable part of the car business, which is auto financing and the service business. And so, but it was it was interesting in the sense the Chinese weren't ready to leave, FAW wasn't ready to leave China and play by a different rule book. They were exporting to markets like Iraq and Syria, and, you know, and they would give this list to me, and I would say, but those are markets where consumers, demand exceeds supply. Consumers are on waiting lists. If they get a car, they're happy. It's not like Mexico where you're going up against the great brands of the world in a very established market. And so that was one of the things that was a challenge. But the distribution part of it was very exciting. And we learned a lot about selling cars, not only through agencies, but through retail environments. And I saw that Think, you actually had this on an earlier program, has just signed a deal in Switzerland with Milagro. I think the electric vehicles are going to have to come to market in a different way. And they're actually going to sell Think through a retail chain in Switzerland in much the same way we were doing there. And so with the retail chain providing, like, the financing and stuff. So I think we'll see more experimentation on the retail side, probably outside of the United States, outside of the franchise laws here in the States.
Yeah, the franchise laws here are probably the strongest in the world. Yeah.
So did they actually sell any of those cars in Mexico?
We did. We sold about 7,500 cars in Mexico.
And what happened? They just didn't want to have to back up warranties and this sort of thing? And they
underestimated. Yeah, they didn't. I think what happened, a couple things happened if I go to the FAW side of the table. Their domestic market was booming, right? So they everything that they were building in their plant, they could sell in China. So that was one. The second thing is I think they thought Mexico was like a lot of other emerging markets, and just they didn't calibrate the level of quality and the level of support and the level of sophistication of the Mexican consumer. And then I think the market equation with the devaluation of the peso, that kind of surprised everybody. Now, had they been an automaker committed to the market, they would have stepped up to those things. That's what most automakers would have done. They would have stepped up, corrected the product quality issues, at least jointly with the distributor, addressed the market equation. But for them, I think it just they realized we're over our heads. And I actually think that this is an interesting challenge for a lot of the Chinese automakers, that they only, with the market booming in China as it is, and with the easy exports they have to some of the emerging markets that they have to assess what are they going to do to take on the mature markets. Geely made a decision to buy Volvo, which I think makes a lot of sense. Chery is going to do it with their own brands, which I think also makes sense. But these are like the new China guys, the young guys, BYD with Warren Buffett and the Electrics. When you look at SAIC and FAW, these are more conservative government-owned entities. And I think they will struggle to leave China unless they do it like SAIC will probably do it with General Motors, unless they do it in partnership with somebody else.
Yeah, but why leave China now? I mean, the growth there is so phenomenal.
Well, I think that what, you know, I actually did a little bit of history. This is what happened when you've been around the business for a long time. When I was meeting with some of the top FAW guys, and they were telling me our quality is good enough, we're selling everything we can build, we really don't, our consumers don't care about all of this, and I'm thinking, I've heard this story before. Let me see. Let me just flash back for a second. Oh, yeah, I remember, and it doesn't end well. You have to prepare. Maybe this moment isn't the time, but you need to prepare for the future being different, because finally, China will have overcapacity, and they'll want to leave China to take on some of these other markets, and you can't get ready by turning a switch. It takes a long time to be ready.
There seems to be something, though, with Chinese business culture, where they don't want to commit full out to something. I've been hearing about this proverbial Chinese, rich Chinese company, or companies, shall we say, that we're going to buy. They'd be here to buy Hummer. They'd be here to buy Jeep. They'd be here to buy anything Chrysler throws off and the GM brands and maybe even Mercury while you're at it and a bunch of parts companies. And some of them did sniff around, and they never buy anything.
But I think it's part of a strategy. I really do. I think part of what they're doing is they are in market intelligence mode. They're gathering information. And so the Chinese government still holds the purse strings of a lot of these things. So they let them kind of go out and learn and, you know, do due diligence and these kind of things. This is, I think, what happened to Hummer. But when you actually come in and somebody has to write a check, they start choosing a lot more carefully about who they're going to back and write it.
But I know some investment bankers who they just dread when some Chinese buyer, well, shopper, shall we say, comes in and wants to take up like 4 days of their time. They have to wine them and dine them and spend 4 days taking these people all over the country to look at these companies. And they know they're not going to buy anything.
Well, maybe not on this deal, but eventually they
will. Well, yeah, that's why they do it.
But it is. I do think that this is just part of the learning process. I think China realizes that one of the resources that they're the shortage of at the moment is leadership who can operate outside of China. And I think part of what they're trying to do here is get this generation of people outside of the country, exposed to different people, exposed to different processes, and then they pick and choose what they really want to do a little carefully. But I wouldn't be surprised. I think in the next 5 to 10 years, probably, after the demand in China kind of stabilizes and the capacity moves up to meet it, I think that you'll find, I mean, there's a lot of money behind, both at the provincial level and at the Beijing level, that they will turn into buyers.
Yeah, there are a lot of
investment bankers aren't always long-term thinkers about stuff like that, though, but yeah.
Right. There are a lot of ex-American auto execs hanging around looking for work, that mid-level and upper level, that they could hire for some of these if they need expertise.
Well, and they're hiring a lot of people as consultants, but I view this as all part of the market understanding mode. When I really think of who's going to actually come in and enter these markets, you know, Brilliance was in Europe. They ended up moving out. Mahindra, the Indian company, obviously has come here and has had issues.
Still hasn't gotten
going.
Still
not ready. Right. I just, I think they underestimated how hard it would be to penetrate these mature markets from a marketing, brand development, distribution standpoint.
Are they underestimating how much money it takes to do all that?
I don't think money's their only issue. I think if it were only a matter of money, they would have money behind them. I think it's really, you know, you look at China, the market-facing processes are not that developed because demand is higher than supply, and so you don't have very sophisticated, like you would have in Europe or Japan or here.
It's not tough to sell.
Dealers, those kind of things. And to come into a market like this where consumers are going to expect so much more, or Western Europe where they're going to expect more, they need more development time to do that. And so I think they're in, but they will be here because they do have lots of resources and it is part of the plan. And so I view it five to 10 years out probably. But Geely will be here with Volvo, right? And I believe that others will come with their joint venture partners. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if SAIC came with General Motors on a small vehicle. And I think that's a very natural way for them to come because they can do the low-cost manufacturing, at least for a while, and engineering, and then depend on their partner for the market-facing processes.
You think they'll build the cars here in the U.S. or they build them in Mexico first? Labor's cheap. You've got trade agreements that are for bringing parts in and sending.
Every single major Chinese automaker has done extensive due diligence in Mexico in terms of plant locations. And so I would think, and they're pretty comfortable, and they actually have a number of them who speak Spanish fluently. I wouldn't be surprised if they started in Mexico first because it would give them the cost base that they want.
Why? Why not just bring it over direct from China?
I think they will also do that, but I think part of the challenge of bringing it from China, you have all the supply chain issues. I think small cars they might still, but you have supply chain issues, you have response issues. And China over time, not just because of labor, will get more expensive, but because of currency, right? As the currency moves up unlinked from the dollar, China will become a more, with the whole supply chain involved, a more expensive place. And they'll want to distribute their manufacturing other places in the world.
So Mexico is going to grow in importance.
Yes, I believe that.
From here on out.
I agree hugely. I've looked into this. I wrote about it a couple of weeks ago on the blog. I think Mexico has no tariff agreements with 25 different countries. So as far as bringing in parts or shipping out your excess production, whether it's cars or parts elsewhere, it's a great place to go. Cheap labor. Mm-hmm. And you can truck or rail stuff up to the U.S. a lot easier than shipping something in a boat across the Pacific.
Yeah, Mexico has more free trade agreements, I think, than any country except for Israel. And it's the bridge to South America, too, right? So you can do exchanges with Brazil and Argentina and these kind of places. Yeah, it's a perfect place to actually set up. So I think Mexico strategically is in a very good place.
Except that it's really violent right now.
Well, you know, I just spent the last couple of years living in Mexico City, and maybe it's just because I'm from Detroit and I don't see as great a difference as some other people who do that. It's always hard to tell. But, you know, the border's bad. I mean, Juarez and some of the other places are very difficult. But Mexico City's one of my favorite cities. I feel the same way about Mexico City as I feel when somebody criticizes Detroit. I'm kind of like, well, wait a minute. Yeah, there's challenges, but there's great things. Mexico City's one of the great cities of the world, too. And so there's a lot of positives about it.
I've never been there.
Oh, it's wonderful. Hmm. Yeah, 23 million people, by far the biggest city in North America, two times the size of New York. So it's a
true mega city.
It is a true mega city.
Hey, going back to the China thing, what do you make of what we were talking about before of all this labor unrest?
I think this is natural. I think it's interesting that the strikes have all been with Western companies and Western joint ventures,
So far, it's only hit Japanese car companies, Toyota and Honda, and now this BMW dealership.
Right, the European. And so it'll hit with foreign investments because it will move them up and leave more space for the Chinese, the wholly owned companies to operate. But what'll happen eventually is that everybody knows what everyone makes now because it's on the internet, right? And so what's going to happen is China's going to move up, I think both because we'll pay more wages and because the currency will be more expensive. And then China will need to source in Vietnam and Malaysia and some other places. They'll develop their own low-cost regional supply chain. And that's part of the natural cycle of things for China, too.
You said something interesting, that it's happening to Western or established companies.
I believe it is.
You think that's the government is allowing strikes? Why is it happening at Western or non-Chinese companies?
I don't think anything's an accident in China.
But there's got to be the same level of discontent at Chinese companies.
I think it's just managed differently for now. And so what will happen is, I think, because they want the wholly owned Chinese companies to expand, and as they're developing better quality and better products, they need to move the foreign brands up and create space for the wholly owned Chinese brands. And that's one way to do it, is just to let labor move it up. And then they'll let that happen for a while, and then they'll have to move all of labor up a little bit, particularly as they look at the labor inequities across the regional areas of China. One of the issues is the inequity of income within the country itself, and they'll have to deal with that through increased wages.
Well, plus at the Chinese plants, every morning they play a videotape of Robert De Niro giving his teamwork speech from The Untouchables with subtitles when he hits the guy in the head with the baseball bat, and they go, "Happy to have a job today, boys."
That's only at Fuking Motors.
Yeah, that's right. So, Kathy, where does that leave us? I mean, where does that leave, say, the U.S. and Europe in terms of being able to compete?
Well, I actually have hope for the U.S. Now, this last couple years of restructuring has been difficult. The recapitalization of not just a couple of the automakers, but of the whole supply chain. While it's been difficult, I think it's left the U.S. auto business with delevered balance sheets, with a much lower cost structure, finally cleaning up brands that for years and years people have pointed out need to focus on the strong brands. I think Ford has debt to pay down because they didn't go through bankruptcy, but the product line looks good, the leadership team looks good, the strategy is coherent. I think GM, obviously the balance sheet looks good, the product looks good, they're getting there on brands. I've listened to the last couple shows. They still have some work to do on the brand and marketing side, I think, but I also have confidence they will get there. Chrysler, I think, will integrate more and more with Fiat. I think what we'll see with Chrysler is that it'll be brand extensions from Fiat, and that's probably the best future for Chrysler in the scenarios that I look at. Europe, I think, will take longer. I mean, restructuring in Europe's not as easy. It'll take a longer period of time. I think the best thing that could have happened for GM is Germany turned them down on the deal, and they can restructure. I think, Dave, you were talking about that in an earlier show. They can restructure the plants in Germany, which they need to do. And
we've got three plants there. They don't need three plants.
They don't need three plants, and they don't need plants that expensive. And so they need to take on the Western European capacity and move it east. And in some cases, take some of that small cars and import them from India and some other, you know, move more of the suppliers to northern part of Africa, which some of the electronics and electrical guys have done. They need to do all of that in Europe, and that's still ahead of them. And I don't think that will be as easy or as fast, but that one will inevitably happen too.
The challenge they're going to have, though, is that Opel is already a pariah in Germany because of the problems with labor and the government. Der Spiegel has this crusade against GM. It's deserved for the most part. They, for the longest time, had an American guy in Zurich telling Germans how to run a car company, and the car company hasn't made money since like 1995 or something like that. It's ridiculous. But if they keep desourcing, which they need to do, but if they keep taking jobs out of Germany, how many cars can they sell there? Their market share is down significantly.
It is, but they're doing well in Britain. I actually think they'll get through the issues.
They're doing well in Britain.
Yeah, I think they'll get through the issues in Germany. I think this is a window. I mean, whenever there's a lot of political focus on issues like labor, they'll keep engineering centers there, which is some of the high-technology jobs. They'll keep tool and die centers. They'll keep sourcing some of the major German auto suppliers who are based in Germany, headquartered in Germany. And the plants will ultimately end up, I think, in Central Europe, and they'll just have to live through the issues, the market-based issues. Until that happens. Until they're profitable. I mean, we're talking about companies that are finally profitable. None of these companies are returning a cost of capital yet, if I'm going to talk like a banker. So
yeah.
none of them are there on that. They all have a ways to go to return the cost of capital
Right. Where
an independent investor would re-up. And so.
So what do you make of the supplier industry, especially here in the U.S.? You're a product of the supplier industry. What's your take on it?
I actually think of 2010. I tell my supplier friends that, and they gulp when I say this. But I actually think we're in the eye of the storm on the supplier industry. We came through the big restructuring, right, of the major suppliers from roughly 2005 till really, I think Visteon still needs to come out, but the last ones are just, you know, kind of coming out now. But what's not happened yet, right now, medium and small suppliers cannot get financing. So when volumes go back up, I don't think financing is going to open as quickly as they're going to need to recapitalize and add capacity. And so I actually think there will be a scramble. And, of course, the big suppliers have cash on their balance sheet. So I think that what will happen is there will be another wave of consolidation on the positive side, or small and medium supplier restructuring if they can't, they don't get bought and can't get financed on the other side of it. And I think that will probably not happen as much until the end of this year, early next year. People are being conservative about their cash. But I think as the minute the volumes really exceed the capacity, then we're in for another consolidation ride. My concern, and this would be a concern on the supplier industry and the automakers, and maybe it's just because I see this every decade or so, during these times of great discipline and difficulty, we've got all these good practices in place in the companies. But every time the volumes come back up, despite all assurances to the contrary, these promises are so easily forgotten on the way back up again.
Yeah, it kind of goes, that was a close one.
That was a good one. Well, leadership changes and automotive amnesia sets in. And that would be my other concern, is that the structure goes back in as the volumes go back up again. And that, I hope that doesn't happen that quickly. It almost always happens. But I hope they really keep it lean for a few more years this time. Because if they do, they'll generate a fair amount of money, which is why I think you still see private equity interested in a number of these suppliers. They bought into the bonds at distress levels over the last couple of years. And if the volumes come up and structure doesn't go in, some people will make money in this part of the business.
How have they bought in? So they're buying distressed assets super cheap. Mm-hmm. Are they doing it with debt, though? Because
they're buying the bonds cheap. They buy, you know, they buy the bonds for less than a 100 cents on the dollar. And so if they can come in and buy, you know, during the last couple of years, particularly in 2009, they came in and bought bonds at like 35 cents on the dollar, 40 cents on the dollar. And now as volumes go back up, they're sitting in a pretty secure place in the capital structure. Or they were in the bonds when the companies rolled out of bankruptcy in a delevered balance sheet. And if the volumes go up and structure doesn't go back in, the profitability will roll out when they IPO.
So they aren't throwing a bunch of new debt on the balance sheets of these companies. Because that's my problem with private equity has been through the last few years. And you saw it even with Chrysler. Mm-hmm. They basically do an LBO. They put a bunch of new debt on the balance sheet, which adds interest to a company that's already not making money at all if they are very thin margins. So you just hurt their margins, and all you get out of it from private equity is the fabulousness of having some private equity guy run the company. I'm not mentioning anyone specifically, Bob Nardelli.
Yeah, mixed results is what I think most people would think. Yeah, the problem with private equity, of course, for them, debt is a cheap way for them. I mean, that's how they get their equity pop, right? But I just don't think they're going to be able. They're in debt right now. They're in the capital structures right now. I think if they could put more debt on, some of them might, but I don't think there's that much headroom for a lot of
them. Why do they think this works with them? I mean, you have manufacturing companies that don't do well carrying a lot of debt. Some of them are already carrying too much, either debt or retiree obligations as it is. And you're going to throw more liabilities on the balance sheet and more interest expense on the income statement, and somehow this is going to work.
Well, I think companies that have high operating leverage, which is what manufacturing companies have, to put high financial leverage on it isn't a good equation. I agree with that. But the time to do it is when you're moving back up the volume cycle and you're looking at some kind of monetizing your investment. And so in an IPO process, it'll be interesting to see what the capital structures look like on the other side.
And you get some proceeds and you can pay off the debt once they go public.
That would be the hope, right? Mm-hmm. Is it a risky game? It is a risky game. Absolutely. And for the private equity guys, it's what they thrive on. For the people who live on the operating side of the business, we're the ones that end up with the scars. If the things go well, it ends up okay. When they don't go well, that's where some of the scars of the business have come from.
Very interesting. Hey, I think it's time to get to some of the viewers' questions and comments. And Ben, you know what I'm going to call on you to do right now? Let's bring up that graphic.
So there's some extra machine gun action this week.
Yeah. Okay, Volt 230 wants to know, are Chinese workers not allowed to strike their own car makers?
I don't know. I would
think that he's onto something, that they're managing it differently when it comes to Chinese companies.
Yeah, it's actually there's not a law against striking. They could strike, but I just think that it's being negotiated on the side. They still have, you know, they have Communist Party union representatives that are involved in the plant who would be mediaries in the negotiations in all of these plants. And I think that when the negotiations break down with foreign companies, they let them strike.
Okay, 007 Mitch W. says, today I hear not only that Ferrari will no longer sell manual gearboxes, but that Lotus will give up the whole Ad Lightness program. Has the earth deep below us moved, or do I need to grow up all over again?
We are in a transition period in this business, you know.
I saw something, but I didn't read it. What do you know anything about Lotus saying?
Well, they're not going to stop what they're doing, but, you know, the Evora is a bigger, heavier Lotus with allegedly 2+2 seating if you're 5 years old in the back. But, yeah, it's inevitable because Lotus is going to find out they're going to make a lot of money, and they're going to keep going into getting away from the super light Exige-type cars and, you know, growing their... Yeah, it is. Hell is frozen over. It's bad. It's all bad. I had a Lotus Europa twin cam once, and it was a great car when it ran, which wasn't very often. This was funny. This is a funny story. In the back, it said Lotus with the individual letters. The T kept falling off. So it'd say Laos. My mom hated that car. So the only car I had that my mom just absolutely despised, that car.
Ashby Crowder. Or Crowder wants to know, is the redesigned Chrysler 300 due out in late 2010 as a 2011, or is it coming in 2011 as a 2012?
We won't see it. It'll be at the Detroit show, and they're saying it's going to be at the dealers, but I imagine it's going to be a 2012.
I think so, too. I thought it was next year.
Yeah, 2012.
Early next year, I think.
Yeah, early next year, but they'll call it a 2012.
True, right. Let's see here. David Foley says, how soon are we going to see any vehicles from Chrysler with the multi-air system? Not yet. Chip was just at the Jeep Grand Cherokee launch, and they didn't want to talk about multi-air on the Jeep at all. My guess is it'll probably be on the Fiat 500, which is not a Chrysler product, but will be sold through Chrysler dealers. So that's my first guess. Mark B. White, why not just make more new cars that are E85 compatible and make E85 more widely available for them?
No, that's what GM's doing, right?
Yeah, I think GM, Ford, and Chrysler, within a year or so, almost half their production is going to be flex fuel. Just need to get something on that. I know we got a phone call here about that. And, Ben, let's bring up that first one where I think one of our... What the nose here tells me, he says E85 is a scam. Let's hear that one.
That's the same guy who called a few weeks ago, I'm sure.
My name is Clem Zarovsky from Delmont, Pennsylvania. I think the addition of ethanol in gasoline is a ploy by the gasoline companies to sell more fuel because your gas mileage drops and you have to fill up more often. Thank you.
Well, he's right. Your fuel economy does drop with ethanol. Everybody keeps saying, oh, it drops 30%. It does not, because people have got to remember E85 actually has 15% gasoline. So your pure drop-off is more like 20 to 22%. If your car happens to have a NOx sensor and can take advantage of the higher octane of ethanol, because it's like 110 octane, it's racing fuel. The guys at Indy run on this stuff. You can actually get it down. In fact, I want to say it's Ricardo did an optimized ethanol engine where they bumped up the compression ratio, super high pressure turbo, blah, 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 all the nine yards. It gets better fuel economy than an engine running on gasoline. But it costs money to do that. So anyway, good point. It does go down in fuel economy. Let's see. George from Brooklyn wants to know, what role did the guest play in the second generation Ford Focus? None. That was after
I left.
But you were building Focuses in Mexico then, or selling them?
Both, actually. Well, yeah. Focus has been in Hermosillo since the first generation, and so it was launched almost a decade ago now, right? It was And so it was built in Hermosillo, and I was responsible for that plant. And then the second generation, I was at Tower, we were suppliers. So I guess a little bit in the sense of...
You liked your time in Mexico, didn't you?
Oh, wonderful.
You know, I got to tell the story. When I first met Kathleen, actually, was at the Detroit Auto Show. I want to say it was 1999.
Yeah.
And you were running Ford Mexico there, but you had come up here with a bunch of Mexican dealers.
2000.
Okay, January 2000. Ford Mexican dealers, and you just learned that you were being transferred back to Dearborn. Yeah. And I'm talking to these dealers, and they're crying. They're crying because you're leaving them. And I went, wow.
Oh, I love Latin. They're just wonderful.
Mike D. White says, what do you think of Chrysler's plan to make a minivan aimed at men?
I mean, they're just throwing stuff up against the wall and seeing what sticks at this point. That's all I can gather from that, really.
Yeah, I agree. I said on the show today, people don't aspire to own minivans. People don't lust after minivans. People buy them because they're just so damn practical. If you got a family, there isn't a better vehicle to have. That's why they buy them. And so to make stylistic or macho minivans is just stupid.
Yeah.
This is as contrived as the couture edition of the PT Cruiser.
That's right.
I mean, just, you have a car that is embraced by the Boca Raton set and only the Boca Raton set, and they're trying to put two-tone paint on it and red seats and call it couture. It's ridiculous.
It's not, right?
Yeah.
Okay, we got another phone call. Ben, let's bring in one of the other phone calls we've got.
Hey, guys. Great show. I had a question for you. What do you think of the rumors that Ed Whitaker is pushing for an above XTS flagship? And I guess the second follow-on question is, do you think the 16 concept would still be relevant, or do you think it's kind of gone past its time with the large engine rear-wheel drive setup that it's got? Thanks, and look forward to hearing from you. Bye.
The 16 was a fabulous concept. Mm-hmm. It'll never see the light of day, but it has influenced everything about Cadillac design-wise. Mm-hmm. So it served its purpose. Yeah, there's been rumors that there's a new Super Cadillac being worked on. So I think it's possible.
It's not approved, but there's work being done. And
no, it's not approved.
They're trying to.
Well, what do you guys think? Is it the appropriate thing for Cadillac to do?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, sure.
I think Cadillac needs to pour it on with spectacular products, mm-hmm. the standard of the world, and keep going.
We know what the XTS is, which is basically an all-wheel drive, large-ish car, but it's still based off a stretch version of Epsilon 2, I think, which is not that big a car, until they have a real flagship. Even if they don't sell that many, if they don't have one, they're going to be seen as sort of like Infiniti and Acura and all these, not near-luxury brands, but kind of second-tier. They've got to go up there and compete with Mercedes.
They need to make a statement.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Joseph N. says, what about Jason Castriotta's firm being hired to design the new Saab? Can Tiny Spiker really afford the Saab turnaround?
I just did a big story on this. I don't think they can. They have enough money to get to 2012 and come up with the 9.5, 9.4X, and the 9.3. But some work needs to be done even for the 9.3. He showed us his 9.2 concept. And then he told me afterwards all he needs is $320 million and a platform from somebody else.
But I wouldn't be surprised if he has a shorter-term strategy to develop one of those beautiful teardrop Saabs. I mean, what really get the development going and then flip it out to a bigger automaker again.
We reported that he is negotiating with BMW to use some mini hardware. Mm-hmm. So it's possible. The question isn't can he find a partner. Sure, he can find a partner to do it. And he wants that to come out in 2013. The question is can he make it from now till then, because he's got to get a lot of sales. He has enough cash to get to 2012, but it's also based on getting up to 120,000 a year global sales for Saab, which is not far from the best they've ever done. This isn't the same market that they did that in.
Right.
Not here in the U.S., not anywhere. So he's in a weak economy and a brand that many of his own fans think is dead because of all of the GM saying we're going to wind it down. It can be done, but it's going to be really difficult for him. The guy's got all the enthusiasm you can imagine. But.
Oh, yeah. No, he's got all the charm and everything. But I think Kathy's right. I think that, you know, all he wants to do is show that it's on its way and flip it to somebody who's got the money.
Right.
Here's a guy who wrote in, Derek Verstegen. I hope I said that right, Derek. He's got a pretty cool idea here. You know, they're talking about making electric cars have a noise so that visually impaired people can hear these mm-hmm. silent cars coming. His idea is that, it's going to be hard for me to paraphrase this, but essentially what he wants are for visually impaired people to have like a phone, a mobile phone, an MP3 player, a keychain, a beeper, and have electric cars broadcast a signal that these devices can pick up. And so they'd make a noise in your pocket or vibrate in your purse or whatever it happens to be. So instead of all these EVs making noises, people who are visually impaired have something that they carry along with them. And I read this and I went, this is a great idea. David, get out and patent it, man. Figure, you know, go get you a patent lawyer because I think you're really on to something there. Okay, so Jason Jadosh wants to know, you said you've driven the new Mustang and Camaro, so which would you buy?
David?
Well, I'd get the Camaro.
Yeah. I'd get the Mustang.
There you go. And I can't make
up. So you're the deciding.
I can't make up my mind. I like both cars.
I like both cars, too, but I'd get the Mustang.
What kind of purveyor of opinions are you?
Ford's got to get me... get me a car to test drive. I want to drive the new V6 Mustang and the new 5-liter. We drove the 5-liter briefly when we had the chief engineer here. But briefly is really good, but I got to live with the car for a few days to really let it soak in and understand what it's all about. So I'm a Ford guy. Normally, my knee-jerk reaction would be go with the Mustang, but the Camaro's pretty good.
The Camaro looks so good that the Mustang would have to run on dilithium crystals for me to buy it over the Camaro.
George from Brooklyn wants to know, question for the panel, how long does SEAT have left?
About 5 minutes.
Yeah.
SEAT, of course, being one of Volkswagen's brands that is not making money. And I think they drew a line in the sand. I think VW said you get 2 years to turn this around or that's it.
Yeah, I think the other challenge is that in markets like Mexico, where SEAT and Volkswagen both compete, they've dragged Volkswagen down.
Oh, really?
And so it's because essentially it's a Volkswagen at less money. Mm-hmm. So as Volkswagen is getting more competitive on some of their key lines, which we see that with the new launches, there's no room for SEAT. I think it just creates brand confusion for
them. Yeah, they're going to get rid of it, I'm sure.
Can they sell the volume, though, in those plants with just... Volkswagen?
I think if they move the Volkswagen, the Jetta down, for example, to a more competitive price, the answer is
they're already doing. They're doing this.
They're not going to at least $1,000 off the price for the
Speaking
new.
Speaking of VW, Stefan Jacoby's supposedly leaving. Going to Volvo.
What? He's negotiating.
Whoa. Say this. Yeah, Stefan Jacoby leaving VW?
Volvo's after him.
Mm-hmm. That just blows my mind.
And,
the guy who's a German.
Volkswagen has basically removed him, but they're still negotiating with him.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Zowie. Okay, J.D. Clough wants to know, do any of you have inside knowledge about the Hyundai Genesis convertible? Sure would make sense.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll see one down the road.
But... Okay, Ben, I know we've got another phone call there. Let's bring it in.
Hey, guys, it's Jonathan Brown in Old Spain, New Jersey, and I think that we should move to E15 immediately. In fact, I think this government should turn around and make E85 available so that we could turn around and run the cars on strict E85 for the vehicles that General Motors produces. And I would imagine for $1,000 we can convert any of the cars. We can get better horsepower if we run them and tune them for E85. So along with the dual-clutch transmissions, we should also have all E85 availability throughout the United States and stop this nonsense importing. Just my opinion. Great show. Have a good night.
That's Jonathan, John will send you your check tomorrow morning.
Yeah, and actually, it's...
Flogging his opinion.
It's dirt cheap to convert a car to be flex fuel. I honest to God, I think the price is under $100. The last I had somebody quote it to me, it was like $85 cost to convert a car to be E85 compatible. It's not expensive. They've gotten pretty intelligent about how to do it. But we don't have enough fuel, enough ethanol right now to give E85 to everybody. But we do have enough to give 10% to everybody, and we're on the road to getting up to E15.
Yeah, the last I heard, they were trying to convert this brewery in my hometown that my dad used to work in, an old Miller brewery, into a big ethanol plant.
No kidding.
Mm-hmm. Miller Brewery, Fulton, New York.
Well, I can tell we have 187 refineries, ethanol refineries, in the U.S. right now. There's something like 14 more under construction and another 7 under construction on top of that that are cellulosic. The cellulosic stuff is coming on stream this year, which is pretty interesting. Philip Stubblefield says, please, someone help John pronounce the name Hyundai correctly. As their own commercials have said over a year, it's Hyundai, like Sunday.
Yeah, let's back up here. The correct pronunciation is Hyundai, and they changed it to sound like Honda.
Right.
For all of you out there who forget, because they were trying to, you know, make it kind of like Honda, but simple for Americans to pronounce, because they didn't want Americans to say Hyundai. So it's Hyundai, and I just think it's bullshit.
Right. It's true. In Korea, and I learned this from Koreans 25 years ago, they pronounce it Hyundai. That's how they say it. Mm-hmm. And so the American marketers got a hold of that, and they went, oh, actually, let me step back a minute, because Hyundai first went to Canada before it came to the United States. And they sold the pony, remember, the Pinto or the Hyundai pony, which Ford sued because there was a pony model of the Pinto. But that's I'm getting off track. Okay. So anyway, there was a big brouhaha in Canada because the marketing people there in their ads pronounced it Hyundai. Hyundai, and Honda went ape.
Oh, they should have.
And they should have.
It was too close.
And I remember the chairman, the then chairman of Hyundai came to Canada, and they asked him, you know, should it be Hyundai or Hyundai or what? And he says, Hyundai, I don't care what you call it, just sell the cars. So anyway, I know my friends at Hyundai keep gently reminding me to pronounce it Hyundai, but I got to tell you, after saying it Hyundai for 25 years, it just doesn't come natural to me. So anyway, that's the story on that. Joseph N. says, hey, I haven't heard the panel comment on the death of the North Star engine. I think David will say business is business, and Peter will say GM should retain the name that's so intertwined with the rebirth of Cadillac.
Ah, he's predicting our comments.
Your answers.
I won't say business is business just because I feel like being difficult, but I don't think they need that many V8s, not with the way the market's going, fuel regulations. I love V8s, but they've got the small blocks, and they're making pretty good use of them in Camaros, Corvettes, pickup trucks, SUVs.
I think, you know, if Cadillac does this standard of the world thing, I think it would be nice if they had their own showpiece motor in there. I mean, they can't just keep stuffing ZR1 motors in CTS-Vs or the B-Series. It would be nice if Cadillac had a super V8 that was equal to anything in the world, if not better.
Well, could they just do it off that architecture and vary it? Because if you don't get enough volume, the investment for a whole new V8.
Well, yeah, I understand that. Yeah, in a perfect world, they would do their own architecture. But, yeah, they could start with that and put their own spin on it.
That's fine. Call it a North Star. And by the time that car comes out, there will be so much time between the old North Star and that engine, no one will even remember what the old North Star did.
I got a story for you. Mentioned the Pinto Pony. Well, actually, it was the Pinto Pony MPG. And back in college, I was such in recurring deep trouble with my points in the state of Michigan for my license. I was in and out of suspensions on a regular basis, and I just went out in the parking lot and I got a ticket. But my friends said, they were threatened that there is a secret facility in the state of Michigan where they have a row of Pinto Pony MPG simulators, and that I was going to be sent there. And every time I went over 55, I would get electric shocks through the pedals and the steering wheel. And that was, they were going to cure me of my, that was funny. I still think of that to this day.
That's good. Here's a question for you, Kathleen. What do you anticipate for the future of Chinese cars in North America? I know you kind of touched on that.
Yeah, well, obviously the first official Chinese cars are in North America. They're Volvos, right? I mean, because they're owned by a Chinese company now.
Yeah, technically, supposedly.
From a Chinese brand standpoint, it'll be interesting to see what'll happen. I think that BYD is one of my picks to be one of the early ones because they can come over with an electric car. It's low volume. They can use alternative kind of distribution.
Lots of incentives.
Lots of incentive. Warren Buffett's one of the investors, so you have a name halo of a big investor here. And so I think that you'll see very low volume kind of specialty as the initial first steps. I think that after that, though, I think within 5 years, we will see mass Chinese brands come into the market. But before they're ready to do that, they need to expand in a lot of other markets first and get their traction. You know, Hyundai was in Canada before they came. Remember, they actually withdrew from the U.S. back to Canada because of the quality issues and then re-attacked the market with vigor.
That's right. Was it the accent that was the really bad one?
It was the product quality.
Well, the first one they had was the Pony, and the quality was atrocious. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. In fact, most people forget about this. They had a plant in Canada, in Quebec.
They did.
I mean,
really?
If you work for Hyundai, you better not step foot in Quebec. They're still pretty ticked off about how they got all this money from the province. They built a few cars and went, this ain't working, and bailed.
And so the Chinese are really benchmarking that because they don't want, you know, in this kind of world, I don't think you get very many second chances to come into big developed markets. And so they have some more work to do, I think, before they're ready for the U.S.
You know, that is a good point. You know, if you fail, usually that's the kiss of death. But Hyundai, see, I said it right, did come back. But they did it. Man, it took them a long time. It cost them a lot of money.
It was the 80s when I thought the Accent was the first U.S. car they sold.
Oh, no, you're right. I'm sorry.
And it was
in the
bad.
U.S., it was the Accent.
One of my high school buddies bought one. It was just terrible.
But in Mexico, I think Chang'an's going to enter Mexico. I think an SAIC product will enter Mexico through General Motors all in the next couple years. Mm-hmm. So I think Mexico, as
Why
part of
GM
North America.
Why would GM help them come over here? Isn't that just...
I think as a small vehicle, if they were to come over, as long as it's sold through a GM dealership and they have all the front end part of it, it's an SAIC produced vehicle through their joint venture, I think it could be part of their joint venture strategy. They're going to come one way or the other.
I know, but
right. This is one from last week, actually. It was for Charlie Hughes, but we didn't get a chance to it. But Peter, I want to throw this to you. How would you manage the return of Alfa Romeo to the U.S.?
Well, let me just say, I love Alphas, old Alphas. A friend of mine had a Giulia Sprint Speciale, which is just a gorgeous car. But, you know, if I'm not mistaken, Sergio's talking about selling like 65,000, 75,000. I just don't see it happening. I mean, if I brought Alfa back, I would bring Alfa back appealing to hardcore enthusiasts, not dependent on a lot of volume, just prestige all the way, the march to a different drummer enthusiast crowd, and make them good values but great performance. And, you know, they're not going to be all that cheap. I mean, I would just go for the hardcore enthusiast market. You get them, and you'll see where it goes. But you're not going to be selling 70,000 Alphas.
So 15,000 to 20,000 maybe.
Yeah.
Something like that.
And forget about Dustin Hoffman and The Graduate and all that stuff.
I'd have the 8C Competizione,
mm-hmm.
that coupe and the Spider, and then something, you know, much more affordable than that. But that's all I would do. I would just go hardcore enthusiasts. And to do otherwise would just be a disservice to Alpha. It really would.
I agree. Okay, we're going to throw the last question to David, which brings us back to the World Cup. Who would you pick to make the finals? The real man's choice would be South Korea for their honest and tough style of play.
To make the finals? I'm going to say, I don't think England's got it together, so I'm going to say it's going to be Germany against Brazil. Not knowing how it stacks up and yet, we don't know who's playing who, but I'm going to say Germany.
At the snapshot in time.
I'm just happy NFL training camp opened this week. I should say hi to Scotty in Cleveland. I didn't say hi to him. And thanks again to Roaster Jack. Did you try any of Jack's coffee?
Oh, yeah. No, his coffee is terrific.
The new stuff he sent last week.
Yeah. No, it's we drinking it. So, Kathy Ligocki, we got to thank you so much for coming in. This
it's
has been
pleasure.
Great
thanks,
having
John.
You on the show. Great insight into the industry. David, Peter, you guys, as always.
Thanks.
Remember, people out there, you can friend us. You can friend us at facebook.com/AutolineDetroit. Follow us at twitter.com/AutoLine. Go to Peter's website, autoextremist.com, or follow him at twitter.com/AutoExtremist. You can find David's stuff at Bloomberg.com and Businessweek.com.
Right.
Any websites you want to push here, Kathy?
No, but I'm an advocate of all of these.
All right.
That's the right answer.
Even better.
Remember, folks, you can get all our stuff on Stitcher, through your BlackBerry or smartphone, just go to our website, outoflinedetroit.tv. You can get all that. Next week, we're going to do all open line. The whole show is just going all to be open line. Get your questions and comments.
No, rapid fire, Jen.
Oh, rapid fire. I'm reading off the wrong thing. Rapid fire all next week. Open line on Monday. But we will do all rapid fire next week.
Synergy Green. That's a special.
But anyway, thanks so much for having in tuned in tonight. Visit our website, outoflinedetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily automotive news fix with Out of Line Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Out of Line Detroit. That's all there and much more at outoflinedetroit.tv.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence.